The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Now it's time for our Friday forum, where we're talking about the big stories of the week, and I suppose some of the lesser ones too. The delay in alcohol labelling, the presidential race, the Occupied Territories Bill, and 16-year-olds voting in Britain. That's all on the agenda for the Friday forum. We're joined by Shane Moynihan, TD, of Dublin Midwest Fianna Fáil TD, Claire Curran, spokesperson for Children, Disability and Equality, and Sinn Féin TD for Roscommon Galway, and Gabia Gatavascaita, political correspondent with the Irish Independent. Good morning and welcome to you all. I'll go to the TDs first, Shane, do you want 16-year-olds to be voting for you?
I think this is something that the Electoral Commission should certainly be looking at. In a previous life, I would have been a lecturer in politics and would have looked at some of the effects of 16-year-olds voting.
And
countries that introduce it, there's no real difference to the overall distribution of party strength. So certainly something worth investigating. And it's something that I think is ideal for the new Electoral Commission to take on as a research agenda.
Claire?
Yes, I do. And we previously had legislation. I think it was my former colleague, Senator Fintan Warfield, brought forward legislation to lower the voting age to 16. I think on lots of issues, most recently climate, young people are actually ahead of the politicians on some issues like that. So I think they should have a say in their future. And yes, I do think they're doing politics in school. They've done CSP at junior cert level in which they can't vote. They're very young doing that subject. So I do believe that the voting age should be lowered. And I think it would be good to do that for maybe a local election and start there.
Okay, what are you about you, Gabia?
Well, look, it's an interesting one. I think it's interesting to see Labour pressing ahead with this in the UK. We have had similar proposals from political parties here as well. I think the Social Democrats were talking about it in the last government. Whether or not it's actually going to happen, I don't know.
I mean, there's the North-South issue. If it happens in Northern Ireland, would there be more pressure to happen?
Does it kind of have to happen here as well? There's not a major push for it. I think there's also an argument of, do voters kind of know what they're doing? And excuse me, I think when you look at budgets, even when you see politicians pushing for pension hikes and so on, like if we are trying to get our young people involved in politics, they're going to have to try and solve the problems for young people, such as housing and health, of course.
Yeah, I was listening to my colleague Shane Coleman this morning. He's pointing out you can't get married until you're 18. Mm. You can't get a tattoo until you're 18. You can't get a drink until you're 18. And yet you can vote if this proposal was to be followed through. What do you say to that, Shane?
So I'd say that's one of the reasons we should research some of the underpinning pieces here as well. I think, you know, oftentimes the debate about this sort of stuff gets zeroed in on one thing, as opposed to a broader piece around political education, around encouraging civic involvement, around encouraging active citizenship and volunteerism. So I would say that, you know, I always get worried about saying, yes, we should give 16-year-olds the votes immediately. We should actually think of how do we ensure that those 16-year-olds and indeed all generations feel involved and participative in our democracy too.
Wasn't that survey during the week, Gabby, about Gen Z thinking that people are old at 35?
Well, also,
old people knocking on the door looking for the vote of the young people.
But also the turnout in the last few elections has been extremely low. I think in the last general election, the turnout was the lowest ever. So if you're trying to get people to come out and vote for you, you might have to open up the doors to other people to do so.
The other thing about that, the electoral register is so out of date that they weren't really sure how bad the turnout was.
The figures are way off. I mean, there's all different election registers for, I think, every county around Ireland. But I think in general, we always talk about, and we hear politicians talking about, you know, female participation in politics. We want to get more people to come out and vote. So perhaps if you expanded it and got the conversation going, it might be easier to do that.
Okay, let's move on to a political decision that was made during the week, Claire, and that is to defer the health labelling of alcohol. Mm.
Yeah, and by 3 years seems quite excessive. I know concerns have been raised in terms of business, and obviously the cost of business is having a real impact on entrepreneurs, on businesses themselves, and that seems to be where this is coming from. But 3 years seems excessive. I don't think the government have explained too much in terms of their rationale for this. My understanding was it would basically be stickers that could be used, that were being prepared and made available by the HSE. And I mean, every food and drink item, give or take, has the nutritional information, which of course wouldn't be the case on alcohol, but it has that, and it has that warning. We see it on cigarettes, and I do think it's important. We supported the legislation, and I don't think the government have been clear in terms of their rationale for this.
Okay, what's the rationale then, Shane?
So I think first of all, let's take a step back and think of the basis law here. Of the 31 provisions in that Act, 28 of those have been enacted. The labelling matter had to be dealt with and assessed by the European Union. obviously the Taoiseach has said during the week that the government is solely focused and is aware of the public health issues associated with alcohol, but we also have to take a whole of government approach to what is possibly coming down the tracks in terms of turbulence with regards to our trading relationship with the United States and so on, and the impact that it will have on food and drinks producers as well. And the Minister of Health has met the Minister of Agriculture, the Taoiseach and Taoiseach, and they are all aligned in terms of their overall approach to thinking that we should take a whole of government approach.
Now, one of the arguments is we'll do it when Europe does it now, whenever that might be, because anything manufactured in Ireland for consumption in Ireland, there's no problem there. The only difference would be they'd have a separate label at the moment for export where that prescription would not be required on the labels.
Exactly right. And that's where that sits into this broader piece around the export piece and drinks and food and drink sector that is looking down the barrel of what could be a disruption to the
friction. Of course, for the importers who are bringing in specialist beers and so on and wines that are not manufactured here, they would have to label accordingly.
It's an extra hassle if you're exporting into Ireland, for example, than other countries. And I will say I had a bottle of wine there last couple of weeks that I bought in Aldi, and it already had the label on it saying, you know, alcohol can cause cancer, and the link to the HSE website. The other point to this that I think has been missed a little bit, I mean, really, Jennifer Carl McNeill as the health minister, she came under a lot of pressure from her own Fine Gael cabinet colleagues, Peter Burke, Martin Hayden, to try and put a stop to this. Simon Harris saying, you know, he does think there is a merit to postponing the delay, and then Alcohol Action Ireland, who's been very much in favour of these labels, saying, look, we're going to save a lot of money if we try and tackle you know, drinking and binge drinking, I suppose, especially in Ireland, in terms of, you know, crime and also health related issues. You know, they're very much so not happy
okay.
that they're.
But I mean, you talk about the bottle you might have bought in Lidl or Aldi or whatever, and they of course buy wine in bulk and then they bottle it and they label it themselves anyway. I mean, they have these Chateau X and Y that you've never heard of and perhaps do or do not exist, I don't know. But if you are buying a Chateau bottled fine wine, and then you have this big HSE thing that you have to stick on.
It's not nice to look at, but...
Not nice to look at.
And I think...
And also suggests that people are swigging the Chateau bottled wines to beat the band to do themselves in with cancer.
Well, look, like health experts are always warning us about how harmful alcohol is and how it can cause cancer. And I think there's never any harm in telling people, you know, what the dangers of something are. The other argument is that this is all nanny statism. But I think it is interesting.
Just quick question. Did you drink the wine with the label on it? Or did you say, oh no, I better not?
I was making a very nice pasta and I put the wine into it and it was delicious. But of course, I'm going to be trying to be mindful of my alcohol intake, Mum and Dad, if you're listening. Yeah.
All right. Let us move on to the Occupied Territories Bill, because what you were talking about there in terms of alcohol labelling and that whole of government approach and what's coming down the tracks. Well, we hear what's coming down the tracks, whether it's from Huckabee out in Israel, the US ambassador to Israel, or from other interests who are trying to lobby the Irish government and Irish politicians against the Occupied Territories Bill. I mean, there are warnings there that this could do us serious harm.
Yes, and I think, you know, to as Minister Byrne said on the Morning Ireland this morning, he was very clear in that we have to make sure that what we do with the Occupied Territories Bill is not misrepresented around the world. Now, as the Irish government sees it, we see that this is consistent to our obligations under the 2024 ICJ judgment to enact a bill like this. But it is very important that we do take our time in getting it right. And I think the opinion poll in today's Irish Times reflects that we're pretty much in lockstep with where the public are at in this, that we should investigate this thoroughly before we make sure that it's not misrepresented abroad by people that might not necessarily have our interests at heart, and that we're not disadvantaging ourselves as well. But equally, that we also ensure that we don't, again, as I said earlier on, turn this into the one thing that defines our response to the catastrophe that's happening in Gaza, and look at it in terms of the overall response the Irish government has taken to what's happening in Gaza, which is consistent with what we're saying.
I mean, the Occupied Territories Bill is referring really to the West Bank.
Exactly, an occupied territory.
Before the catastrophe in Gaza was unfolding. But the other question is, and I think it was raised by some people like Alan Chatter, saying there are other occupied territories in the world where China, for example, is in places it should not be. Are we doing the same to China as we're preparing to do for Israel?
I think what we're taking it with regard to this is that there's been a judgment from the ICJ that has put an international obligation on states to do that with regard to Ireland's interaction and member states' interaction with those occupied territories in Israel. And that's the response that we're taking in response to that.
Fair.
Well, look, I mean, how much more time do we need? How long is the Occupied Territories Bill around at this point? And we're talking now about the possible consequences. Like, you would imagine the possible consequences would have been well examined at this point. The government have been on about legal advice and legal advice other than that from the AG. And we've had all of that. And like, the reason Israel is the priority now is the fact that probably every minute now in Gaza, men, women and children are being killed. So, of course, the occupied territories in the West Bank are the priority because that is where the genocide, that is where people are being killed every day of the week. And that has to be the priority. We've heard from the Secretary General of Amnesty International saying it will be minimal. The loss will be minimal in terms of any impact on Ireland. And I think at the end of the day, we have to do the right thing here and we have to look at Gaza and we cannot turn our faces away from
what
is happening.
I mean, the impact economically is tiny. I mean, I was listening to Alan Shatter talking the other morning about this, and he said something like over the last 5 years, 600,000 euro worth of stuff has been imported.
Goods, yeah. And I think it's difficult for the government here when it comes to the services part of the legislation, which the opposition and some campaigners are calling for services to be included, because they cannot quantify actually what is the value of the services that are implemented here and also in the occupied territories. The common example that's always given, of course, is of Airbnb operating there and operating here as well. And also, how do you go around that? I know IBEC is also pushing back on that sense. So I think the government is mindful as well of what the business lobby is saying here, especially in the face of Trump's threatened tariffs.
So what do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think they will press ahead with the version of the Occupied Territories Bill that they have put forward, which the opposition say is not really what Francis Black put forward at all. And like when you see The Hill had an article, you know, a very respected outlet in Washington, D.C. this week saying how eventually this is going to come back to really hurt Ireland and especially the Irish-American relationship. I think the government's very worried about that.
I suppose it will all depend on how trenchantly international public opinion now turns against Israel, given we played a clip from an Israeli-American academic saying, I know genocide when I see it.
Yeah, and I think it's those photographs and harrowing images and footage that we see day in and day out that's coming from Gaza. Like, it is impossible to stand over it. And the government says, look, this is about sending a message internationally. I think to some extent they're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't, because whatever they do here in Ireland, they're told you're not doing enough. And then on the international stage, people are saying, look, you know, this accusation of being anti-Semitic is coming towards Ireland, which of course ministers have strongly refuted.
Now, let's move on to the presidential election, which is has to happen before Michael D. Higgins leaves the Oras in November. So we've a couple of the runners out at the moment. We have for Fine Gael, we have Mairead McGuinness, and we also have a candidate partially of the left. Well,
somewhat
very left, but not with all the support of the left.
Not really this united left that we were expecting. They could unite yet. Labour have said that they're not made up their minds on Catherine Connolly just yet. Of course, she used to be a Labour Party councillor.
And of course, she campaigned against Marie Sherlock down in Dublin Central.
And she, you know, she left Labour. That was a long time ago. They're saying it'll be before the end of July before they make up their minds. Catherine Connolly, in fairness to her, she's out of the trap and she's doing, you know, interviews and press conferences and so on. Fine Gael are hiding Mairead McGuinness and they're saying we're not going to have her out until the end of the summer. That is when our campaign's going to formally kick off because they're worried about how bruising these presidential campaigns can be.
All right. And now, will she, won't she? Mary Lou McDonald, Claire.
Yeah, well, look, obviously the consultation is complete now within the party. I know from feedback from my own Cumann and Corlea Cantar back home, it's a very mixed bag. Some members don't want us to run our own candidate. They want us to row in behind another candidate. It's a very mixed bag, so I think it's going to be difficult to make a call on it. I don't see Mary Lou McDonald running for president. Perhaps she will, but I don't see it. But it will be determined by our membership, and that consultation was really, really important.
I mean, looking at the risks involved, if you win it, that's fine. You're there for seven or 14 years. Nice little retirement package for anyone who gets to live in the Oras, et cetera, et cetera. However, if you lose it and you're a party leader and you lose it, you've lost it.
You can't really stay on, and I mean, as party leader, I think that's the debacle for both Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil now. Both their party leaders, some within the party, believe Micheál Martin and Mary Lou McDonald should go first, that they'd have a good chance. But like, realistically, there can only be one winner in the end. And if you're not in it to win it, and if you don't win it, like, really, what happens to you then? And more importantly, who takes the position of party leader in your party?
Okay, Shane, then it's over to you.
Are you asking me, am I running? I think I barely qualify the age threshold, Pat, so thanks very much for that. Look, I think it's obviously one of the most important offices in the country. And I think it's right that parties take time to think about consulting internally about how the best way is that we get someone that represents the values and the spirit of the country as well. The Taoiseach has said that we're going to do that process over the summer, and after the summer we'll have an idea of who that person that we believe should be the president. I think sometimes we get obsessed with the political horse race of what is actually a very important office. It is above politics. It is something about that represents values. And I think if you look at the long line of presidents we've had, Michael D. Higgins, Mary Robinson, Mary McAleese, those campaigns and elections have been characterised by a lot of independent candidates and people that wouldn't have had a party political background as well. And I think that shows the nature of the office itself as well.
Now, what about Bertie Ahern?
I mean, look, ultimately, I think we have to go to someone that will be reflective of the values and spirit of the country as well. I don't think Bertie's indicated an interest that he wants to run for president. That process will happen internally in Fianna Fáil, and we'll have a bit clearer eye after the summer of what candidate we can.
I'm just wondering from the perspective of your colleagues how Bertie is regarded, because it would have been the smart money would have said that Bertie would have his eye on the park.
He hasn't said that to me. He hasn't approached me with that, so I don't know. I don't know if that is the case.
But how is he regarded these days? I mean, he's back in the party, having been excluded for a while.
I think Bertie has a lot of achievements to his name as well, in terms of his work in the peace process. A lot of people would associate his work since then as being someone.
And we know all of that. But the question: how is he?
You asked me how he's regarded, and I'm giving you the answer to how he's regarded in relation to that broader piece. But I think in terms of who our presidential candidate will be, that's something that we will look at internally and say who can represent the values and for all the country and for all the people of Ireland.
Are you ruling Micheál out entirely?
Well, I think Micheál has said himself that he wants to continue as Taoiseach. He's doing a
great
job.
A lot done, more
Taoiseach.
To do is the kind of line he was.
Well, no, it's that we are going to take the time to think of who should be the best candidate for our party.
What say you? I mean,
well, so of course we had Mary Hanafin. I mean, really, she kind of pulled the trigger on this on the presidential race. In some ways, she said, "Look, it would be an insult if Fianna Fáil didn't run anybody," and she'd be happy to contest. I don't know if the party is as mad for Mary Hanafin. Maura Geoghegan-Quinn, first female cabinet minister, she's also rumoured in the papers this week. Like, the reality is that both Sinn Féin and Fianna Fáil don't really know what they're going to do. And in some ways, that's a good thing because they have time to make up their minds. So whoever their candidate is, they're not being torn apart in the media for the entire summer. And some may call it silly season. I certainly wouldn't. But on the other hand, it's like, well, what are you going to do? Like, you can't not contest the election.
Do you agree with Mary Hanafin that it would be a shame for Fianna Fáil not to contest?
Well, like, sorry, they have the Taoiseach's position. It's a very important election. Yes, they don't really have much to gain from it, from what is, you know, kind of an unimportant election politically. Because, of course, even if your candidate wins, they have to leave all their politics at the door. But, like, you know, it's the Taoiseach's party. They can't really not contest it,
I would say. We had a discussion on the programme during the week, though, about whether or not the Constitution actually says what the President can say, and a lot of criticism of Michael D because he's been quite outspoken. But one interpretation was that when you're addressing the House of the Oireachtas or speaking on behalf of the nation, you have to clear everything. But otherwise, you can pretty much say what you like.
Clear everything by the government first.
Yeah, you don't have to do that.
Look, Michael D. Higgins certainly threw the rule book out, and I think that's what opens up the pitch this time to sort of those other kind of candidates. I mean, Catherine Connolly, of course, you know, Galway TD as well. I think she probably feels, you know, boldened by the fact that Michael D. Higgins had two terms in office, and she probably thinks, look, I've had a good chance and I'm going to follow in his footsteps.
Okay, if you were Sinn Féin, then I won't go back to Clare or to Shane. Who would you nominate for Fianna Fáil? Who would you nominate for Sinn Féin?
I think that if we had Mary Lou MacDonald and Micheál Martin, it would be a very interesting contest. I think Mary Lou MacDonald does have a very good chance, and Micheál Martin would, of course, have all of his arguments, and it would be very entertaining for me as a reporter to cover it, which is most important, of course.
But you're not nominating anyone from Sinn Féin other than Mary Lou and other than Micheál Martin.
I don't, I mean, like, certainly when you speak to people in both parties, they think they're the best fit. I think you should put forward your best candidate and sure, let politics play out then.
All right, on that very cordial note, Gabby Gataviskaite, political correspondent with the Irish Independent, Shane Moynihan, TD, Dublin Midwest for Fianna Fáil, and Claire Curran, TD, spokesperson for Children, Disability and Equality, Sinn Féin TD for Roscommon Galway. Thank you all very much for joining us. Now, don't forget, our items from today are uploaded as podcasts, which you can listen to on the Newstalk app, powered by Go Loud. Just search for The Pat Kenny.
The Pat Kenny Show.
With Aviva Insurance.
On Newstalk.